This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to a reading of the Braille Monitor, a monthly magazine published by the National Federation of the Blind. Material is selected with the interests of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. This program is funded in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. This is Ray, and our program today will bring you articles from Braille Monitor Volume 68, Number 8, October 2025. Let's get started. What is Braille Monitor? Early Access by Chris Danielson. Since 1957, with some exceptions, the Braille Monitor has been published in print, Braille, and audio formats 11 times a year. Issues in those formats were mailed to subscribers for most of that time. But soon after we established our website, we began publishing the magazine online as well, and making it available as an email to subscribers who opted in. Today, subscribers can still receive hard copy Braille and print editions and emails, and the audio edition is available as a thumb drive mailed to readers, online, and as a podcast. Our magazine can also be read on NFB Newsline. In short, while remaining consistent, the Braille Monitor has evolved with changing times and new methods of distribution. Braille Monitor Early Access is our latest effort to continue that evolution. As of now, we will make an effort to publish new, relative content and connect to other timely Federation resources, such as our press room, on the section of our website dedicated to the flagship magazine of our movement. As some stories develop, we may update them, and we will clearly indicate when we have done so. We will not compromise truthfulness and accuracy in posting this content. Our aim is to make the Braille Monitor the go-to source for the most current information about the Federation and the blind community. We will do this in a manner that is consistent both with our own standards and the standards of modern journalism. Many stories that appear in Early Access will also appear in the regular publication, but they may be different from how they originally appear. And if so, we will clearly indicate that. Some other content may be exclusive to this page, depending on whether it is still relevant when the next regular issue goes out. But all of it will be Braille Monitor content that conforms to the quality and standards that our readers expect. In his article introducing me as the new editor of this magazine in our December 2024 edition, President Rick Obono said, "As we move to a new editor, we have another opportunity to rethink and reformulate how our flagship publication represents our aspirations for the future. If we do it right, in 20 years, the Braille Monitor will be the source of accurate information for we dealt with the pressing issues we face today. Furthermore, it will serve as a reliable measuring stick for the progress we have made as it has since 1957. The new Early Access features seek to advance and enhance those goals. The communications teams who helped make this is a reality, particularly my colleagues Erin Rodney and our team lead, Stephanie Cascone. Join me in looking forward to your feedback on this feature, as well as in all our content and on other innovations we might make to enhance the voice, reach, and power of our flagship magazine. Reach out to me directly at cdanielson@nfb.org. Once again, that's cdanielson@nfb.org. Or shoot an email to communications@nfb.org. Once again, that's communications@nfb.org. Happy reading. 20 Years of Dr. Edward C. Bell and the Institute on Blindness by Gary Wunder. The Professional Development and Research Institute on Blindness, PDRIB, is marking the retirement of Dr. Edward C. Bell after 20 years of leadership, 2 decades that turned aspiration into program and program into a pipeline of professionals who expect competence from blind people and teach accordingly. Dr. Bell is the Institute's 3rd director and by far its longest serving. During his tenure, approximately 200 students have passed through PDRIB's program, many of them now shaping classrooms, centers, and agencies across the country. What makes this institute singular is not just its location on a university campus. It is the first sustained university-affiliated training center and blindness created by leaders in the organized blind movement and operated accordingly to the philosophy of structured discovery pioneered by the National Federation of the Blind. Through its cane travel track, it remains the only university-based degree program that explicitly prepares instructors to teach structured discovery cane travel, a collaboration that changed the center of gravity. The Institute grew out of a late 1990s partnership between Louisiana Tech University and Louisiana Center for the Blind, a center run by blind professionals. That collaboration has now spanned more than 25 years and continues to anchor PDRIB's immersion training and mentorship model. When Dr. Bell assumed the directorship 20 years ago, the Institute's goals were more aspirational than specific. His first job was to refine the mission, then build the machinery to carry it out. Curricula, clinical placements, faculty development, and a credentialing pathway that could certify new graduates and recertify working practitioners at regular intervals. Today, PDRIB's close work with the National Blindness Professional Certification Board, NBPCB, links preparation to standards, examinations, and ethics. The core structured discovery. Structured discovery is not a bag of techniques, but a philosophy for teaching and learning that puts the blind learner at the center. Where the traditional approach treats blindness as a deficit and casts the professional as the authority who prescribes narrow tasks to be copied, structured discoveries treat blindness as a characteristic to be managed with alternative, non-visual skills. The learner is active. The professional is a mentor who uses modeling, Socratic questioning, and well-planned experience so that students internalize problem-solving and self-monitoring. Stated plainly, the goal is not to teach what to think, but how to think. Teaching what to think confines a person to a script. Teaching how to think equips a person to meet the unknown. For this reason, PDRIB requires deep practice rather than surface proficiency. Blind role models rather than low expectations and honest difficulty rather than overprotection. The national certification framework that grew up around structured discovery cane travel formalizes these exceptions and exam domains and continuing education requirements. PDRIB offers three graduate pathways that embody this philosophy. Orientation and mobility, Master of Arts in Counseling and Guidance, the only university-based degree designed to prepare instructors to teach cane travel using the structured discovery methodology. The program requires an immersion quarter and extensive fieldwork. Rehabilitation Teaching for the Blind, Master of Arts in Counseling and Guidance, a cross-training program in Braille, daily living skills, access technology, and cane travel, founded to supply broad, competent teachers who can meet varied needs. Teaching Blind Students, Master of Arts in Teaching, preparation for K-12 classrooms with acquired Braille mastery, access technology competence, and the expanded core content teachers actually deploy in schools. Two of the three insist on immersion. Students complete 400 to 480 hours at an approved center such as LCB. During the training day, they wear training shades, 8 hours at a time, so that non-visual techniques become reliable and efficient under real-world conditions. This is not denial of residual sight. It is a curriculum choice that ensures skills hold when lighting, fatigue, or disease makes vision unreliable, and that people with progressive loss are not trained twice. Opponents sometimes argue that shades ignore remaining vision or create unnecessary difficulty. PDRIB's answer is that consistent non-visual proficiency reduces anxiety, supports better generalization, and reframes identity. Functioning is the point, not how much one sees. The result is steadier performance and, in time, higher expectations by teachers, by families, and by blind students themselves. Research, publishing, and building our own house. PDRIB's job is not only to train, but to ask better questions. As Dr. Bell often says, you can have rigorous methods and impeccable measurement, But if the underlying question assumes dependence and low confidence, your data cannot speak beyond these assumptions. The Institute's mission commits it to research that broadens and deepens our understanding of blindness and the best ways to promote independence, and to follow the data even when results complicate our hopes. The reality of publishing that work has sometimes been rough. Early on, as Dr. Bell recounts, we were frankly the ugly stepchild of the academic world, and we wrestled with gatekeeping that seemed to judge the byline more than the disease. The response was not withdrawal, but construction. Help launch and lead venues where rigorous, consumer-driven research could be judged on its merits. The Journal of Blindness Innovation and Research, JBIR, the first scholarly journal created by blind people through the National Federation of the Blind to focus explicitly on independence and self-determination, stands at the center of that effort, and Dr. Bell has served as a part of its editorial leadership. Beyond journals, the Critical Concerns in Blindness book series, which Dr. Bell has edited, translates expectations into practice for families and teachers. Volumes such as Getting Ready for College Begins in Third Grade, An Independent Movement, Travel and Blind Children put practical, high expectation counsel into the hands of people who need it most. Two scholarships and a path to the PhD. Along the way to his doctorate, Dr. Bell earned two National Federation of the Blind scholarships, one in 1995 and another in 1998, when he returned as a Tenbrook Fellow, a designation reserved for prior winners who will win again. Those dates show a thorough line of scholarship, persistence, and increasing responsibility that would soon carry him into the doctoral world and then into the directorship at Louisiana Tech. Why structured discovery matters. The scientific method is simple in outline. Observe, hypothesize, test, replicate, but hard to live. Fields develop momentum. Journals enshrine their assumptions. People are people. In blindness rehabilitation, those assumptions have too often divided the world into caregivers and the cared for. Structured discovery rejects that frame. It assumes capacity, teaches generalizable skills, and insists that independence is the default, not a miracle. This insistence has measurable consequences across reading media, mobility, and employment, and it is reflected in PDRIB's research, reports, and national surveys that tie high expectations and comprehensive trainings to better outcomes. The human part. Leadership is not a straight line. Dr. Bell has spoken plainly about his early years. My first several years here were plagued with imposter syndrome. I felt way out of my depth, newly minted PhD director of this program. I'm just a kid who finished college. It was very hard for me to adjust to this role. That candor helps students and colleagues see the work for what it is. A demanding craft learned in public, with real consequences for the people we serve. 20 years on. What remains after 20 years is a living system built on four pillars. Preparation joined to standards, a university program created by blind leaders, taught with high expectations and aligned to national certification. Immersion tied to philosophy. Hundreds of hours under shades, side by side with blind teachers and students, until non-visual methods feel ordinary. Research that asks the right questions. A publishing and training ecosystem. JBIR, book series reports that keeps independence at the center. A collaboration with DEPTH, the Louisiana Tech Louisiana Center for the Blind partnership that has lasted more than a quarter century and still shapes how new professionals are made. Dr. Bell set out to articulate a mission, build an infrastructure, and strengthen a credentialing system able to maintain standards over time. He did that. But the most important thing he did may be the least visible. He helped a generation of teachers, mentors, and scholars understand that our job is not to teach a script, but to equip a mind. When you teach how to think, independence follows. May his next 20 years be as personally rewarding and helpful to blind people as his last two decades. Remembering the why, the purpose, and the philosophy. My Journey to Becoming a Structured Discovery Cane Travel Teacher by Denise McInstant, NOMC. From the editor. Denise McInstant is a cane travel instructor based in Washington State, where she lives with her husband, Gary, and has been a member of the National Federation of the Blind since 1970. This article is adapted from remarks she gave at the Contemporary Issues in Rehabilitation and Education for the Blind Conference, put on by the National Blindness Professional Certification Board as part of the 2025 National Convention. Along with her compelling personal story, the article contains much insight into Federation philosophy and its relationship to the structured discovery teaching methods that are a hallmark of Federation training centers and increasingly accepted throughout the blindness field. Here's what Denise shared. In 2005, I finally obtained my dream job. I completed the training to become an orientation and mobility instructor. I passed my certification test for National Orientation Mobility Certification, NOMC, supervised by the National Blindness Professional Certification Board, NBPCB. That next school year, I was hired at my first job as orientation and mobility instructor. My path to this point had been a long journey of mentoring, philosophy, and practical skill building, a journey that started many years earlier. While in high school, I met blind peers for the first time. In addition, I met teachers of the blind and mobility instructors who worked with these students. I became friends with some of these blind high school students. The mobility instructors were interns attending the California State University at Los Angeles Master's Program in Orientation and Mobility. I became fascinated with what they were doing. My blind friends had not received any training before then. At the time, it was widely believed that blind people were not mature enough to use a cane until age 16, as if cane travel were akin to driving. On campus, blind students used a sighted guide or did their best in the crowded halls trying to avoid other students. Mobility instructors were exclusively sighted, since it was presumed blind people could not teach cane travel. This practice continued until the 1990s. My friends did not use their canes outside of mobility instruction. The low expectations and discrimination faced by my blind friends became especially clear during the Los Angeles teachers' strike in 1969. Administrators decided to sequester blind students in the nurse's office for their safety. Many of the blind students saw this policy for what it was, custodialism. This custodialism was predicated on the assumption that blind people were unable to be responsible for their own well-being. All the students at this high school were expected to be safe. Protocols were put into place to protect all the students during this work stoppage. But the blind students were singled out. It was the first time that the blind students did not have advocates, adults, or other students to stand up for them. It was a time they learned that standing up had to be done by them. During this period, the campus became open, allowing students to leave school grounds if they attended class. For blind students, this was the first chance to travel independently. The experience was a turning point, one that revealed to them and to me that their independence was possible and in their own hands. After high school at graduation, I enrolled in college with the intention that after receiving my BA, I would transfer to California State University at Los Angeles to go into the Orientation and Mobility Program. This was my dream. In 1970, my blind friends introduced me to this organization that they had become involved with. This was my introduction to the National Federation of the Blind. Like many others, I did not intentionally join the Federation for an altruistic reason. It was 1970 and we were out on our own and wanted to have active social lives. Members of the local Federation chapter happened to throw good parties. I was 18 years old and obviously I was drawn to groups that I could enjoy. This was a time of social upheaval and fast changes in the lives of Americans, including blind Americans. As time went on, the side of me that wanted to be part of advocating for a better world for all people, including blind people, made my interest in the National Federation of the Blind more important. I attended my first California State Convention in 1971. The national representative was Dr. Jernigan. His speech and presence had a profound effect on me. As a sighted person, I began to try to figure out my role in this organization that was directed by and for blind people. I was still intending to go to Cal State at Los Angeles to study to become an orientation and mobility instructor. I met and was impressed by many O&M professors in the field. However, I was influenced by the belief that an instructor needed sight to teach travel with a cane. This belief was so ingrained that I had the audacity to write a letter to Dr. Jernigan saying that I did not believe that a blind person could teach mobility. He responded in the kind and understanding way that he always did. I began as a result to reevaluate this belief. I later learned that he had used my letter as a discussion item at a leadership seminar. I must admit that I had mixed emotions about that. I finally realized that this was a compliment. In my NFP chapter, there were several former students of Dr. Jernigan from Iowa. They were the first individuals I knew who demonstrated the advanced skills, particularly in mobility, that they had received at the Iowa Commission for the Blind. They demonstrated the use of a longer cane, the ability to advocate for themselves, and a belief in their own self-determination. I was intrigued, and as a result began to ask questions and research what was happening at this unique training center. In 1973, I met someone who became the most important person in my life. Little did I know that Gary McInstant would become a lifetime partner. We married in August of 1973. We have spent the last 52 hours together. It was rough the first couple of years, as Gary sent out 200 resumes to colleagues throughout California to get a teaching position. He finally got a part-time job at Los Angeles City College. We felt in 1974 that we needed to attend the National Convention of the Federation to learn more about blindness and the movement. The convention cemented our belief that the National Federation of the Blind was going to be an important organization in our lives. I continue to consider my role as a sighted person in this organization. Dr. Jernigan said to me that what I held in my heart about the possibility of blind people being in control of their lives was all that mattered. This statement was important to me. Because of the need to frequently move for Gary to improve his career, I was unable to get the university training I would need to teach orientation and mobility for many years. But both Gary and I continued to learn and grow in the National Federation of the Blind. In 1975, we were invited to a leadership seminar in Des Moines, Iowa. Gary was elected to the board of directors of the American Brotherhood of the Blind, later to become the American Action Fund for Blind Children and Adults, which historically had worked with the deaf-blind and had a publishing house of print/braille, Twin Vision Books. After the 1976 convention, Gary took a job with Blind Industries and Services of Maryland. This agency was developing an NFB-based blind training program. Gary was the director of the rehabilitation department at BISM. I got a job at the City of Baltimore program for recreation for special needs populations. This included working with blind and other disabled individuals using the city recreation services. The director of this program was John McCraw. John became an important mentor for me. He was the president of the Maryland affiliate of the National Federation of the Blind. Here again, I was able to get to know a strong and independent blind person. John spent much time with us taking and helping us learn. Our time in Baltimore gave us the opportunity to get to know people who would be lifelong friends and mentors. Don and Shirley Morris, Jim and Sharon Omveg, John and Connie McGraw, Dr. Jernigan and Mrs. Mary Ellen Jernigan, Judy Sanders, and many more. We moved to Boston, Massachusetts, for Gary to start working for the Office for Civil Rights at the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. Later, the U.S. Education Department. We remained friends with those we knew in Baltimore. Our time in Boston was important because we adopted our daughter, Amanda, while we were there. Again, I had to postpone my dream of becoming an orientation mobility instructor to put emphasis on my family. We moved to Washington State in 1980, and with Bennett Prowse, Hazel Tenbrook, and Marcy Carpenter, we organized a new affiliate. In 1982, our son Eric was born. We have been in Washington State ever since. During my time in Washington, in conjunction with other community activities, I became a known advocate for families with blind children. I worked with parents in a positive and proactive way, introducing them to the Federation policy while supporting their efforts to raise blind and low-vision children. Some of these children had significant additional disabilities, such as intellectual disabilities, deafness, emotional/behavioral disabilities, and mobility disabilities. This was a tremendously satisfying experience for me. Subsequently, I worked as a Braille transcriber/para-educator for 10 years. One of the most rewarding experiences I had was to receive the National Federation of the Blind Distinguished Educator of Blind Students Award in 2001. I am proud to be the first para-educator to receive this award. In 2002, I finally had an opportunity to begin a graduate program in orientation and mobility instruction. Stephen F. Austin State University in Texas received a grant to train teachers of orientation and mobility in the Northwest United States, which included Washington State. I was eligible to participate in this cohort. The classwork was conducted by video conferencing. A group of us met at the closest college with the facilities to do our lectures by video. The second year, we met by telephone conferencing. I really missed meeting in person with my fellow students. I received my blindfold training in Boise, Idaho over a four-week period. We didn't even use our blindfolds the whole time because we traded off in a two-person team. This program also used the guided learning curriculum and philosophy. We did not use structured discovery, SD, techniques, or philosophy. As you know, this was not near enough time to become proficient with the use of a cane with a blindfold. In addition, a person cannot develop confidence in their skill to teach under a blindfold within such a short period of time. I brought to the training my own NFB cane. This identified me as a Federationist. A sense of suspicion among the university instructors infused the experience at first. When they saw that I participated to the best of my ability, they relaxed some. I did say that I was willing to use a different cane, but I felt for safety's sake, I would insist on a longer cane than prescribed. This was not a problem because they could not find the right length among the canes they were using, so I just assumed my NFB cane. I performed my skills at an acceptable level to complete the instruction successfully.
Hello, today I'm going to continue reading off from where I left off on the article titled Remarks of the 2025 National Federation of the Blind Scholarship Class, page 553. Resolution 2025-06 regarding internet service providers. Whereas many Americans rely on the internet to access information, and whereas internet service providers are necessary for connections to the internet, and whereas many blind people rely on access technology to connect to the internet, and whereas many blind people own access technology they cannot use because they cannot connect it to the internet. According to the National Library Service for the Blind and Print Disabled, only 20% of BARD users are able to connect directly to BARD. Despite free and low-cost equipment that would enable them to do so. And whereas most internet service providers either do not have or do not readily make available to local representatives of their companies any employees with knowledge of screen access technology or any technology used by the blind. And whereas internet service providers often utilize tax dollars to participate in federal, state, and local programs to provide free or low-cost internet service to low-income users. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the National Federation of the Blind and Convention, assembled this 12th day of July 2025 in the city of New Orleans, Louisiana, that this organization demand internet service providers hire qualified blind people to make sure that their services are accessible to the blind. And be it further resolved that this organization demand that internet service providers provide specialized assistance to help blind people connect to the internet, including in-person services where necessary, and be it further resolved that this organization urge internet service providers to consider screen access technology users in any electronic or printed instructions or training materials. And that diagnostic indicators such as light available to sighted users have a non-visually accessible substitute. Be it further resolved that this organization urge any government agency administering grants to internet service providers for programs that provide free and low-cost services to low-income users be also ensure that those programs are accessible to people with disabilities, including the blind. Resolution 2025-07 regarding Medicare telehealth benefits. Whereas in March 2020, Medicare telehealth benefits were expanded to help mitigate the risks of exposure to COVID-19 by allowing Medicare beneficiaries to conduct virtual checkups with their physicians, and the expansion of these benefits was of great value to blind and low-vision Americans. particularly those who live in rural areas, who may have difficulty securing reliable transportation for regular physician visits. And since that initial expansion, the expiration date for these expanded telehealth benefits has been extended by Congress numerous times via continuing resolutions, and these extensions, while providing more time for blind and other Americans who may have difficulty traveling to their physician's office, have not made the expanded telehealth benefits permanent. And on March 5, 2025, President Rico Bono sent a letter to all members of Congress urging them to make these telehealth benefits permanent through legislation. And in the most recent continuing resolution that was passed in late March, Congress included another extension to the Medicare telehealth benefits, which, though helpful, once again sets an expiration date. And if Congress does not act, the expanded Medicare telehealth benefits that were extended with March's continuing resolution will expire on September 30th, 2025. Now, therefore, by the National Federation of the Blind and convention assembled this 12th day of July 2025 in the city of New Orleans, Louisiana, that this organization call upon the United States Congress to make permanent the Medicare telehealth services that are currently scheduled to expire on September 30th, 2025. Resolution 2025-08 regarding recent changes in the operation of the Social Security Administration. The United States Social Security Administration, SSA, was created in 1935 and for nearly 90 years has provided financial protection through retirement, disability, and survivor benefits. And two critical programs that affect blind Americans are operated by the SSA are Supplemental Security Income and Social Security Disability Insurance. And the effective and efficient operation of SSI and SSDI ensures that the blind Americans and other Americans with disabilities are able to afford basic monthly expenses such as their mortgage, rent, or groceries. And in February 2025, the SSA announced that its plans to reduce the number of employees working in administration by approximately 7,000, or 12%, to historically low levels in spite of facing historically high demand. And in March 2025, the SSA announced that there would be changing the overpayment withhold rate from 10% back to 100% of the beneficiary's monthly SSDI payment. And in April 2025, following a letter from the Federation, National Federation of the Blind and the Social Security Administration announced that the maximum overpayment withholding rate for SSDI payments was being reduced from 100% to 50%, which is still outrageous. And the reduction in staffing of field offices and telephone services is a recipe for disaster that will result in crowded offices with overburdened staff and absurdly long wait times for people who need their problems to be addressed as soon as possible. And with withholding 50% of a beneficiary's monthly SSDI payment, which many recipients depend upon to pay their monthly bills, in order to reclaim an overpayment that was an error of SSA and not be a recipient is unconscionable. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the National Federation of the Blind and convention assembled this 12th day of July 2025 in the city of New Orleans, Louisiana, that this organization urged the Social Security Administration to reconsider its approach to staffing reduction to facilitate effective and efficient processing of beneficiary claims and problems, and that this organization demand that the Social Security Administration reinstate 10% overpayment withholding rate for a beneficiary's monthly SSDI payment. Blind employees routinely encounter inaccessible software tools when joining new employers, creating barriers to productivity and career advancements. And modern startups and enterprises rely heavily on cloud-based software as a service solutions for collaboration, project management, human resources, finance, and equity management. Blind entrepreneurs with the capacity to create jobs and bring innovative ideas to fruition are disadvantaged when packages commonly used at startups are not accessible. And although some platforms such as Slack and Microsoft 365 offer robust accessibility features, the vast majority of widely adopted tools such as Monday.com, Smartsheet, Jira, including Atlassian's Confluence and Product Discovery modules, and Carta have significant accessibility defects which make them difficult or impossible for blind people to use. And even systems with partial accessibility often fail to meet a higher standard of being not only accessible and usable, but a joy to use for blind employees, thereby disadvantaging both employers seeking to hire blind talent and blind professionals striving for a workplace equality. Ensuring accessibility in enterprise tools requires no legislation, only sustained spotlighting, advocacy, and collaboration with software providers. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the National Federation of the Blind and the convention assembled this 12th day of July 2025 in the city of New Orleans, Louisiana, that this organization call upon all providers of enterprise software to adopt and rigorously implement the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines 2.2AA and to engage in formal accessibility testing with blind users before general release. Be it further that we urge major SaaS companies, including but not limited to Atlassian, Monday.com, Smartsheet, Upwork, and Carta, to seek the advice of blind people when conducting audits, devising plans to remediate accessibility barriers, and publishing roadmaps towards full compliance. And be it further resolved that we encourage employers to prioritize accessibility as a first order citizen when selecting internal tools, thereby driving market demand for inclusive design. A human research protection program is a comprehensive system within a research institution designed to safeguard the rights, safety, and welfare of human research participants. And an institutional review board is a committee within an HRPP that reviews and monitors researches involving human participants to ensure their rights, safety, and welfare are protected and that research is conducted ethically and in compliance with federal regulations. Researchers inside and outside academia must gain approval from an IRB to conduct research, but accessibility barriers in the IRB approval processes make it more difficult for blind researchers to gain the necessary approval. And the Office of Human Research Protections is primary federal agency responsible for protecting human research subjects and ensuring that HRPPs comply with federal regulations, and the Food and Drug Administration also regulates HRPPs and provides guidance for their operation, particularly for clinical investigations involving FDA-regulated drugs such as biological products, drugs, and medical devices. And the Association for the Accreditation of Human Research Protection Program accredits HRPPs and AAHRPP accreditations signifies that an organization adheres to its rigorous standards for conducting ethical research and protecting participants. None of these entities, the OHRP, the FDA, nor the AAHRPP, explicitly requires HRPPs to ensure that their processes are accessible to blind researchers. And blind people have a right to conduct research like our sighted peers. Blind researchers have important perspectives to offer in academic discourse on any topic because of their valuable lived experience. The medical model of blindness, ableism, and the vision industrial complex are systemic belief systems that promote low expectations, like the idea that blind people can only be human subjects in research to be studied, and never the people conducting the study. And inaccessible HRPP processes, including trainings, forms, and web portals that researchers must use to engage with HRPPs as they conduct research, create barriers to the full participation of blind researchers in HRPPs, marginalizing the blind researchers and also jeopardizing the ethical standards that the programs aim to uphold. Now, therefore, by the National Federation of the Blind and the convention assembled this 12th day of July 2025 in the city of New Orleans, Louisiana, that this organization urges the Office for Human Research Protections, the Food and Drug Administration, and the Association for the Accreditation of Human Research Protection Programs to explicitly require that human research protection programs make all processes, including trainings, forms, and web portals, fully accessible to blind researchers. Resolution 2025-11, regarding the coverage of continuous glucose monitoring devices by Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Blindness is a common complication for people with diabetes, and the incidence of blindness increases as life expectancy increases, and more people are diagnosed with diabetes. The traditional monitoring system requires the use of lancing devices to place a tiny blood sample on a test strip, a procedure that is difficult for blind or low vision people to perform. And continuous 24/7 glucose monitoring now provides users with glucose readings using a smartphone app through an exterior adhesive skin sensor. And real-time glucose monitoring is a major component of effective diabetes management, whereas CGM offers a more practical and accessible way for blind people and low vision people to monitor their glucose levels. Medicare Part D, administered by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, provides coverage for lancing devices to all people with diabetes who qualify for the CMS service, but only covers CGM devices for those who take insulin by injection or pill. CMS does not recognize the additional benefits CGM devices provide, such as helping users identify problematic foods or triggers for blood sugar fluctuations. The CMS policy of denying CGM devices coverage to blind and low vision people who do not take insulin is discriminatory, inequitable, and detrimental to their health. And when Medicare is available, it demands to be considered as a primary insurance provider. And private insurance providers such as Blue Cross and Blue Shield companies have discontinued prescription benefits and transferred them automatically to Medicare Part D. The cost of CGM devices is prohibitive for many people compared to the cost of lancing devices. CMS and private insurers appear to be denying CGM devices primarily to reduce costs. Now, therefore, by the National Federation of the Blind and the convention assembled this 12th day of July 2025 in the city of New Orleans, Louisiana, that this organization demand that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services end its discriminatory practice of denying continuous glucose monitoring coverage to blind and low vision people who do not take insulin. And be it further resolved that we urge the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to actively engage in partnership with the National Federation of the Blind to include coverage for all continuous glucose monitoring devices for blind and low vision people with diabetes who qualify for Medicare Part D services, thereby ensuring better diabetes management and healthcare outcomes. The National Federation of the Blind, the transformative organization that advances the lives of its members and all blind people in the United States, recognizes that blindness crosses all boundaries of race, class, gender, and geography. And therefore, our movement reflects the full diversity of the American experience, and blind people continue to face deeply entrenched barriers that limit our full potential in society, not due to our blindness, but because of systemic inaccessibility, outdated perceptions, and inclusions from the policymaking process. The members of the National Federation of the Blind organize, advocate, and mobilize to build a society where blind people live independently, work competitively, access education equitably, and are full participants in a community and civic life, not as recipients of charity, but as equal members of society. We fight for the non-visual accessibility of technology, infrastructure, and services because accessibility is not a luxury. It is a civil right, and its implementation benefits everyone through inclusive, forward-thinking design. Our independence and dignity are protected by civil rights laws that we have fought to win, which we must now fight to preserve. And across the country, we are witnessing a disturbing trend of executive orders, legislative rollbacks, and regulatory changes often carried out without consultation, transparency, or understanding that threaten the civil and human rights of blind people. And these actions, whether driven by cost-cutting, misinformation, or political expediency, disregard the lived experiences of disabled Americans and risks reversing decades of hard-won progress. In 2025 alone, our movement has issued powerful, timely, and evidence-based statements to confront misguided policies and demand justice, including comments supporting the FTC's consent order and accessible and opposing promotion of ineffective overlay solutions, objections to Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton's position in Texas versus Kennedy, defense of access to Medicare telehealth options, opposition to proposed rule changes weakening the Randolph-Shepard program, advocacy for full funding of the Institute of Museum and Library Services, protest of executive orders seeking to dismantle the Department of Education, a forceful response to the Social Security Administration's harmful policy proposals, testimony to Congress defending the National Library Service for the blind and print disabled, opposition to proposed rule changes by the Department of Energy that would roll back accessibility rules for new construction. Blind Americans demand, not request, a seat at every table where decisions are being made that affect our lives, our rights, our futures. The National Federation of the Blind, a non-patriotism organization, will not remain silent while the rights of and futures of blind Americans are being debated without our voices present. Now, therefore, by the National Federation of the Blind and the convention assembled this 12th day of July 2025 in the city of New Orleans, Louisiana, that this organization demand all publicly elected officials reject reactivity, exclusionary, and uninformed policymaking, and instead commit to transparent, accountable, and inclusive decision-making that centers the voices of those directly affected. That this organization demand that the elected officials consult and partner with the National Federation of the Blind and other national disability-led organizations when proposing, revising, or dismantling laws and policies that affect blind people, recognizing our expertise, leadership, and right to shape the system that governs our lives. The National Deaf Blind Equipment Distribution Program, better known as I Can Connect, regularly publishes and updates the equipment that can be distributed to qualified programs and participants. It has come to the attention of the National Federation of the Blind, Deaf Blind Division's Technology Committee that the Braille Sense 6, a blindness-specific piece of note-taking technology, was classified by the NDBEP as a personal computer. In discussions with the program administrator via email on this subject, it became clear that the Deaf Blind Division that this classification was solely done for expediency. In discussions with the vendor of this technology regarding this classification, the vendor indicated that it had no clue that the note taker was being classified as a computer. The Deaf Blind Division Technology Committee, while consulting with the National Federation of the Blind Access Technology Specialists, who manage the International Braille and Technology Center for the Blind and other stakeholders, determined that Braille Sense 6 was likely classified as a computer due to the cost of the item, nearly $6,000. The current rules of the program specifically state that clients may only have one computer, and since the Braille Sense 6 note taker is classified as a computer, if a client needs or requests the note taker to go along with the computer, the client runs the distinct risk of being asked to return a computer that they have been assigned in order to be awarded the use of a note taker. The National Federation of the Blind and the convention assembled this 12th day of July 2025 in the city of New Orleans, Louisiana, that this organization urges the National Deaf Blind Equipment Distribution Program and its network partner, the Perkins School for the Blind, to work with the National Federation of the Blind to find an appropriate note-taker classification so as to classify the clients and other interested programs that Braille-based note-taking technology is a note-taker and not a personal computer. That this organization demand that the I Cannot and its network partners refrain from classifying note-taking technology as a personal computer simply because of the cost of note-taking technology. This organization demand that the I Cannot Connect program administer and their network partners educate trainers and state-authorized agencies to inform clients about the differences between a personal computer and a note-taking device intended for the blind. The Institute of Museum and Library Services was established in 1996, and the mission to advance, support, and empower American museums, libraries, and related organizations through grant-making research and policy development. And the IMLS is the largest source of federal funding for libraries in the United States, distributing hundreds of millions of dollars to institutions in all 50 states and districts of Columbia each year. There are more than 120,000 libraries across the country, which serve as important centers for community engagement, the furtherance of literacy, extended research, and internet access for Americans. State libraries for the blind and print disabled in states across the country depend upon funding from the IMLS in order to provide a critical source of Braille and other specialized audiobooks for blind and low vision Americans. On March 14, 2025, President Trump issued an executive order 14238 that directed the elimination of the Institute of Museum and Library Services as well as several other agencies. And without funding from the IMLS, blind and low vision Americans across the country will lose access to critical services provided by state libraries for the blind and print disabled. By the National Federation of the Blind and the convention assembled this 12th day of July 2025 in the city of New Orleans, Louisiana, that this organization demand that President Trump rescind the directive to eliminate the Institute of Museum and Library Services in Executive Order 14238, and that this organization call upon the United States Congress to ensure that the state libraries for blind and print disabled remain fully funded via the IMLS grant to state program for the 2025 fiscal year and beyond. Regarding universal availability of PDF redemption tools, the portable document format PDF is commonly used for the dissemination of a wide range of electronic documents. And Adobe, the creator of PDF, has developed a method of tagging a PDF document to ensure that it is accessible to blind people using screen readers. And failure on part of a PDF creator to tag a file correctly may render this document inaccessible. And Acrobat Pro includes comprehensive accessibility checking and redemption tools to identify issues like missing tags, alt text, document reading order, forms, tables, lists, etc., headings, and those wishing to use such tools must purchase Adobe Pro at a minimum of $19.99 per month, and no such redemption tools are available in the free Adobe Reader. Verifying the accessibility of a document is so fundamental that it should be not a dependent on the user's ability to or willingness to pay. Now, therefore, by the National Federation of the Blind and the convention assembled the 12th day of July 2025 in Louisiana, that this organization call upon Adobe to implement accessibility redemption tools in Adobe Reader, thus ensuring that accessibility check and redemption tools are available to all. For more than a decade, the National Federation of the Blind has sought to address discrimination against guide dogs users by rideshare drivers, and multiple lawsuits and settlements with rideshare companies did not result in hoped reduction in denials. The National Federation of Blind has continued to engage with rideshare companies, including via protests outside their office on October 15, 2024. Federation members expressed additional frustrations over the cumbersome and time-consuming process of reporting denials to share ride companies, and National Federation of Blind leaders conceived of and proposed voluntary self-ID opt-in systems by which rideshare companies themselves could automatically detect, deter, and deactivate drivers for such denials, greatly reducing the reporting burden on riders. Those systems would also provide companies with data confirming our assertions that riders with service animals suffer denials at a much higher rate than other riders. The National Federation of the Blind demanded that those systems be voluntary for riders and that investigations of all denial complaints be given the highest priority and weight, whether coming from those systems or not. The Federation insisted that the rideshare companies ask no more than whether a service animal is required to a disability and what service it is trained to perform when the rider registers to use those self-ID systems, as those are the only permissible inquiries under the American Disabilities Act. The Federation also demands that drivers only be told about service animals after accepting a ride so that denials will not escape detection. Both Uber and Lyft acceded to our demands and agreed to develop a pilot such systems based on our proposals. Members of the National Federation of the Blind participated in both Uber and Lyft pilots of those systems, and Uber and Lyft made changes to way their respective system work in response to the feedback of Federation members. Federation members and other participants in the pilots indicated that those systems greatly reduced the burden of reporting denials, and both Uber and Lyft have now made those systems available to all riders in the United States who wish to use them. By the National Federation of the Blind and convention assembled this 12th day of July 2025 in the city of New Orleans, Louisiana, that this organization commend Uber, and Lyft for implementing National Federation of the Blind proposed voluntary self-ID opt-in systems for riders with service animals, and that this organization encouraged Uber and Lyft to continue working with the National Federation of the Blind to improve experience of their platform and service riders. Regarding an immediate motion to dismiss Texas versus Kennedy, Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 is a landmark civil rights statute for people with disabilities, protecting us from discrimination by federal agencies and recipients of federal funding in public education, working readiness programs, healthcare, election, and court systems, and more. 17 states' attorney generals have filed suit in Texas versus Kennedy, alleging that Section 504 is unconstitutionally and should be entirely or partially enjoyed, limiting it is only those programs, services, and activities directly funded and through the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. In the status report submitted on April 11, 2025, the 17 states wrote that they have no intention to seek any relief from this court on the count three of their complaint, and nothing in plaintiff's complaint seeks to restrain the disbursement of federal funds from the Department of on the basis that Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act is unconstitutional. The plaintiffs also seek for the court to declare the final rule titled Non-Discrimination on the Basis of Disability in Programs or Activities Receiving Federal Financial Assistance, released by the United States Department of Health and Human Services on May 9, 2024, which contains valuable website accessibility rules pertaining to federal government websites as illegal and unconstitutional. If plaintiff's demands is granted, it will have a devastating effect on blind Americans' rights to effective communication and reasonable accommodation in connection with government programs, services, and activities, including but not limited to education, employment, housing, healthcare, and other forms of civic life. By the National Federation of the Blind and Convention assembled this 12th day of July 2025 in the city of New Orleans, Louisiana, that this organization immediately call upon Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton to move to dismiss the Texas versus Kennedy lawsuit because of far-reaching and harmful effects the lawsuit could have on Section 504 and the lives of blind and other disabled Americans. This organization calls upon Attorney Generals of Alaska, Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Indiana, Ohio, Kansas, Louisiana, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, South Carolina, South Dakota, Utah, and West Virginia to immediately withdraw from the Texas versus Kennedy lawsuit. Regarding urging the American Civil Liberty Union to support accessible electronic ballot return for voters with disabilities, the American Civil Liberties Union presented at the National Coalition on Accessible Voting on April 15, 2025 to clarify its positions against accessible electronic ballot returns for blind voters and other voters with print disabilities. The ACLU expressed concerns about electronic ballot returns that it admitted were not based on existing evidence of breaches or security failures, but rather on theoretical possibility of undetectable interference. The ACLU's chief technologist acknowledged that there is no evidence of current security breaches with modern accessible electronic ballot returns technologies. The National Federation of the Blind and other NCAV members appropriately responded that such concerns do not justify the exclusion of voters with disabilities from the rights to vote privately. Both federal law and moral imperatives mandate that no voter should be required to forfeit privacy, independence, or accessibility in order to cast a ballot. The accessible electronic ballot return technologies already in use offer a promising path forward that does not inherently compromise election security and must be given serious solution-oriented considerations. By the National Federation of the Blind and the convention assembled this 12th day of July 2025 in the city of New Orleans, Louisiana, that this organization urged the American Civil Liberties Union to reconsider its current position and to work in partnership with us and larger disability rights community to develop, support, and promote accessible, secure, and independently verifiable ballot returns and options for all voters, including the blind and those with print disabilities. You have been listening to the Braille Monitor, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or Braille, please call 508-797-1117. Once again, 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.com, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. If you have an idea for a topic to explore, please contact Audio Journal at 508-797-1117 or email info@audiojournal.com. I'm Saba, and thank you so much for listening.